I'm Ruth Dussault with Local News Matters. Today we hear the last in a three-part series called The Tunnel Vision, a look at California's $20 billion solution to its water crisis, the Delta Conveyance Tunnel. To understand how the landscape of the Delta arrived to such a fragile state and to understand the challenges of its restoration, we have to know what it looked like before industrialism. We have to go back to a time before Europeans arrived. We have to take the history trip.
The history trip. This landscape is like nothing else on Earth, and was of that stature historically.
That's Chuck Bonham, director of California's Department of Fish and Wildlife. He's speaking to the State Water Resources Control Board about the challenges of restoring a landscape that's been so heavily engineered for so long.
A history of species abundance that had grizzly bears and tulier elk and tens of millions of birds, meandering temporally and spatially complex habitat types, hundreds of creeks, our two biggest rivers crashing in to an estuary that really is unlike any other on the planet, except perhaps for the Okavango Delta in Botswana.
Almost 200 years ago, Argonauts tore open Sierra mountainsides with water cannons in search of gold. The runoff raised the floor of San Francisco's Bay Delta watershed all the way from Sacramento to the Golden Gate. Around the time of the Civil War, the federal government issued reclamation permits for cheap swampland. Settlers removed native tule grasses and built levees around their farms to dry out the soil enough to take a plow.
They'd use steamrollers, but they'd also use like sheep and other methods to like remove the tule.
Allison Whipple is the science director for the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute.
And also early in the reclamation days, there was a lot of burning. The fire would actually often get into the peat itself and burn, you know, feet worth of peat in a matter of a very short while.
Carson Jeffries is a fish biologist and a senior research ecologist at the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences.
Over the last 100 years of that process, is as we've kind of slowly worked that peat, it keeps on getting lower and lower and lower. They're constantly pumping water back into the channels because there's so there. I mean, some of them are 30 feet below sea level. So when you're on one side of the levee, it's dry land, but it's 30 feet up to the water, you know, particularly down in the Western Delta.
The Delta is now the delivery point for half of California's water supply. And now the state says a tunnel is needed to safely convey water under the Delta in order to secure water for 27 million people from the risk of saltwater contamination.
If we have, you know, the combination of sea level rise, you know, a high tide, a king tide event, and a major storm kind of all coming together and some major levee breaks in some key locations, it would be fresh water. And there'd be a lot of fresh water that's heading into the bay and out. However, after the flood peak has passed and those levees are broken, that would mean that salinity could shift into the Delta, so in the dry season.
But what happens when those levees fail now, when they're 30 feet below sea level, is you don't have a marsh anymore. You just have a lake. And that lake is predominantly going to be occupied by non-native species.
What's wrong with a lake?
So then you have a different landscape. It comes to a question of, are we trying to put the landscape into a trajectory that is more supportive for native species and also one that we think is going to be more resilient and able to adapt to climate change in the future? Or are we going to let these sort of novel ecosystems go how they may as we continue on our business as usual path?
We triage drought, we triage flood, we triage, you know, when levees fail. And the thing that gets me when I think about this is that the environment always loses in triage.
Recently, the state has been working with scientists and water agencies to try and rebuild the floodplains to restore native fish habitats using nature-based solutions, ideas drawn from the land's memory.
But really, we can think about the margins of the Delta with sea level rise. If we are able to let tidal water reach those extents, that over time, those can recover and be maybe more reflective of what the Central Delta historically looked like.
Delta tribes, like the Shingle Springs Band of the Miwok, have managed to preserve a canon of traditional knowledge specific to the ecology of the Delta, but only recently have they been invited to respond to restoration plans. Melissa Tayaba is the tribe's vice chair.
Traditional knowledge is going to save the Delta. It's taking the landscape and doing what it's naturally supposed to do. And I think that what happened is as the state progressed, I just don't think that they saw land the way we did.
I just wanted to have like a floodplain connected to the river. Like, I'm not even asking for very much, like, let alone like think about how we value the river, the source of value that it brings to us as humanity. It is one thing to be like, to a manager, be like, I need to do this because we get more fish. It's another thing to do that, like, I need to do this because it's good for everybody. Like, well, you can't quantify that. You know, it's really hard. And that is the space that I currently live in, and I struggle with it every day.
Non-native people may not understand that the earth is alive, that water is alive.
You've been listening to The Tunnel Vision, a three-part series about California's Delta Conveyance Tunnel. You can find the full report and Climate One podcast at localnewsmatters.org. This has been a production of Radio Sausalito and Local News Matters.